Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the show, a program designed to help undocumented workers who have assisted solving a crime to become U.S. residents. It's backlogged and they could be deported. But up front, the minimum wage in Pennsylvania is $7.25 an hour, the same as the federal minimum wage. Pennsylvania's minimum hasn't been increased since 2007. Both President Joe Biden and Governor Tom Wolf have proposed raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour nationally by 2025 and in Pennsylvania by 2027. However, it is a contentious issue between supporters who say it will lift perhaps up to a million people out of poverty and opponents who counter that it will cost as many jobs and maybe more because employers won't be able to afford higher wages. One of the hallmarks of this debate is that both sides can make what sound like good arguments, often citing statistics they say prove their points. So what we wanted to do on Smart Talk today is to find a source who has studied this issue thoroughly and without a political agenda. And we think we found that person in Dr. Aaron Dubé. He's professor of the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences in the Department of Economics at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. Dr. Dubé, welcome to the program. This is not a simple question. It's not as simple as people earning higher wages or far fewer jobs. Or is it?
Thanks for having me. So, the minimum wage is a very popular policy. But of course, any policies, we may think of the intended consequence and then we worry about the unintended consequence. So when you raise the wage, that certainly helps those at the bottom. But economists sometimes have also worried about, and politicians and voters, whether that leads businesses to hire less people. So I think that's a reasonable worry. I also think that the evidence so far in the United States from lots of different states raising minimum wages, the federal government raising the minimum wage, the weight of that evidence to date, in my reading, suggests that the wage gains are very real. They're very substantial. Job losses have been pretty modest to date. That's not to say that $15 federally by 2024 would necessarily have the same impact as we've seen in the past, but it does seem encouraging that the minimum wage is able to raise wages and lift people out of poverty without having a lot of negative impacts, especially on jobs.
Now, you know, I don't want to get too far in the weeds because you have done extensive research on this. And I want to talk about that research because it is more so than where I've seen almost anywhere. But talk about, I want to go kind of back to the beginning for this. I mean, you've been studying this for a long time, but just recently, you researched the effects of the minimum wage for the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom. And you sourced a lot of studies on this issue. How did you conduct your research?
Yeah, so in 2019, I was asked by the head of the Treasury in the UK, which is the Conservative Party government, to look internationally at what happens when you raise the minimum wage. So I looked in evidence from US, from UK and other developed economies with an eye on what happens when the minimum wage is set at a pretty high level. And so I looked at, you know, over 55 studies across different contexts, across different countries, but mostly from the United States, because that's where we have most of the research. And what I found is that in general, the wage effects of raising the minimum at the bottom are quite strong and pronounced, but the employment effects, they're not particularly large. There are some studies, however, that do find relatively high evidence of job loss. But then if you take a second look at some of those studies, it seems less likely that they're as reliable as some of the more comprehensive studies. you know, one of those comprehensive studies, I will say, I conducted with three other researchers in 2019, also looking at 138 different increases in the minimum wage in the U.S. between 1979 and 2016. And we tracked what happens to the overall number of jobs when the minimum wage rises. And what we found is for the 5-7 years following each of those 138 increases, when you compare states raising the minimum wage, let's say like New Jersey, versus states that did not, let's say like Pennsylvania, you actually don't see changes in the growth in the number of low-wage jobs. And that was encouraging because that suggests that at least to this day, we see the minimum wage being a fairly successful policy. Now, following my report, the Conservative Party in UK decided to further increase their minimum wage to 2/3 of the median wage in that country. Just to put that in perspective, $15 in 2024 would be around 2/3 of the median wage in this country.
And, you know, and that's one of the things that you often don't hear. When I say you, now, you researchers who look into this, take a deep dive into it, May. But often when you hear, I don't know, I would maybe describe them as superficial debates about the minimum wage. You often don't hear the word median being used. And I think that's a good measurement for what it means. But I want to talk about one of the studies that you didn't cite specifically, but it's gotten a lot of attention. In fact, you wrote about it in a column just last week in the Washington Post. The Congressional Budget Office, which a lot of people look at as being fairly reliable, estimated that a raise in the minimum wage to $15 an hour nationally would lift almost 1 million people out of poverty, but it would cost 1.5 million jobs. What about that research?
Yeah, so that's a really good and important question. So just to put it in perspective, the Congressional Budget Office came out with their projections based on other studies, and they said that 27 million workers would get a raise. At the same time, 1.4 million fewer jobs would be there as a result of the $15 minimum wage. So to put that in perspective, the wage gains that they think are going to happen are substantially larger than job losses. And that's what leads almost 1 million people out of poverty, according to their projections. Overall, wages, if you take their number seriously, would grow a lot more than the job losses. So working Americans would come out substantially ahead. At the same time, I think the 1.4 million job loss is too pessimistic. And so I wrote that explained that in my column in the Washington Post last week. And the reason is that I think they ended up putting more weight on a handful of studies that I think have been called into question. I'll give one specific example, and that's a study that got a lot of attention a few years ago. It's a study of what happened when the city of Seattle, raised its minimum wage. And there were researchers from the University of Washington that conducted a study. And I found a very large job loss. And that one data point turns out to matter a lot because the Congressional Budget Office basically took some kind of an average of 11 studies. And one of those is this particular study. And that got a lot of attention. Now, here's the thing. The same researchers more recently came up with another study that found job losses that were about 1/10 as large. And that more recent evidence did not get used by the CBO. And so I think there's a number of issues and limitations in the CBO's estimates of not using more up-to-date research, also not putting as much attention on more reliable research. When I actually followed the CBO's methodology for my UK Treasury review, but used more evidence to bear on the question, I would find that the same minimum wage increase that they studied would lead to at most a few 100,000 fewer jobs as opposed to 1.4 million fewer jobs.
If you're just tuning in, we're talking about the minimum wage and thorough research into the minimum wage by Dr. Aaron Dubay. He's a professor in the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences Department of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. If you'd like to weigh in, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Couple clarifications here. When you say job losses, are you talking about people actually losing their jobs or just jobs not being created?
That's a great question. So I think most people, when you think of job losses, think of individual people losing a job. But really what economists here mean are fewer number of jobs out there. So maybe fewer jobs being created. And also it's important to keep in mind, this doesn't mean that 1.4 million people are somehow going to be without a job forever. What it really means is that you end up spending a little longer between your jobs when you're unemployed, for example, looking for a job. So you may spend several days more on average, right? Instead of if there's 1.4 million fewer jobs. Because remember, this is being spread out over 27 million people who are getting a raise. So overall, what it means then is you spend a little longer without a job, but when you do have a job, you have a lot higher pay. So that's why when you think about the next 3 years, you can average that out, you actually come out ahead with this wage increase, even if you take the CBO estimates, which I again think are somewhat too pessimistic.
And I just had a question from a listener, and I don't know whether you can answer this or not, because it's basically a question for the CBO. But why didn't the Congressional Budget Office use those updated figures, those updated statistics, updated research?
So in 2019, they did a study. They did the same, you know, to try to answer the same question. And that's where they basically did the employment estimates using these 11 studies. I'm not sure why they didn't use the more updated version even then from the Seattle evidence, because it was available. So I can't speak to why they weren't able to use it. This time around, they didn't really do anything differently. Except the following. So they didn't actually reconduct their employment analysis. They were basically just using the same 11 numbers that they did in 2019. But this time, instead of taking the median or the midpoint of those 11 numbers, they took an average. Now that sounds like, well, what's the difference? Well, it is different because if you take the average, if you have a really big number, that boosts the average more than does the midpoint. And as a result, just that one change led them to conclude there would be 1.4 million job losses instead of maybe less than a million. And that's an important, you know, but small change that actually ended up having a, you know, sizable impact on their projections. And one of the reasons it did that is they implicitly put more weight on that one big negative number from the early Seattle study.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're discussing the minimum wage and research into the minimum wage by Dr. Aaron Dubay, professor at the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences Department of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He's thoroughly researched this issue. We're talking about some of his findings. If you have a question or comment, and they're starting to come in, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Let's take a phone call from Faith in Lancaster Township. Faith, you're on Smart Talk.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm on speaker. I'm assuming you can hear me.
Yes,
we
can.
Two questions for your guest. One, what about the possibility of, like, a regional minimum wage based on like a median? I heard you use that term for an area, say like a mid-Atlantic or whatever. I know the Labor Department gathers info about minimum wage or about wages, average wages, minimum in different areas. And then second, since we go through this and it's such a struggle every few years, what about a COLA comparable to what a Social Security recipients receive?
Mm-hmm.
And
Faith,
I'll hang up.
Okay. Faith, thank you very much for your call because she asked two very good questions. Let's start with the regional minimum wage. What about that? Because, Dr. Dubé, let's face it, $15 in central Pennsylvania goes a lot further than $15 an hour in even Philadelphia, but L.A., New York, places where the cost of living is much higher.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I think they're different smart ways of setting up the minimum wage. Clearly, $15 does go further in central Pennsylvania than in New York City. The way we end up doing it in this country is that we set a federal floor, right? So there's a federal floor that applies to everyone, but then you have cities and or states and even cities that have actually raised the minimum wage further. So we have 29 states that actually have a federal minimum wage, a state minimum wage that exceeds the federal standard. These states tend to be higher wage, higher cost of living areas. And we have more than 40 cities that have gone and exceeded the state standard or the federal standard. And cities in general are more costly than non-urban areas. So that's the way that I would think about the federal minimum wage, is setting a floor, especially for those states that has gone at this point for a dozen years without raising the minimum. But is it possible to have regional differences in the federal standard? It's possible. It turns out it's not super popular. and people seem to want to have a single federal number and then allow states and areas, other areas, to go above that. But it's not an unreasonable question and possibility for actually having some regional variation in the federal minimum wage.
Is that fair, though? I mean, when you have such a wide disparity of cost of living in some areas to hold, I think of rural areas of Pennsylvania, for example, to the same minimum wage as what there would be in an urban or a suburban area that is doing quite well.
Well, again, so I think maybe the way to think about it then is what's the wage you wouldn't want any part of the country to fall below? And you set that, right? And then say, well, if, for example, in Pennsylvania or in Massachusetts, voters want to go beyond that minimum, they can and they should. And, you know, in many cases they do, not in Pennsylvania, but in right now, but in 29 states, for example. And so that's not necessarily the only way to do things. And I think, for example, if you had some regional differences, so take a dollar amount and then say, well, what's the cost of living in this state or in this region on average, and then, you know, modulate the minimum wage based on that. I think that would not be an unreasonable approach. It hasn't been used, and in general, it seems that most people prefer to have a flat amount. That's not to say that makes it right? But it is thinking of that flat amount as what is the minimum that you would not want any place to go below in this country is the way that we have approached it so far in this country.
So, Faith, there's the answer to the second part of your question. Here's a question from Abby at Millersville University. She says, how will paying a $15 minimum wage affect small businesses that are still reeling from the pandemic? This is one of the arguments by those who do oppose, especially at this time, do oppose a minimum wage increase to $15 an hour. What about that? I mean, obviously, we're in a recession, or the pandemic has caused a recession. A lot of people are saying this is not the right time for this.
Yeah, no, I think that's an important thing to recognize in general that small businesses, especially in the hospitality sector, face exceeding difficulties in this environment and need a lot of help from the federal government. I think that the way I would think about it is about the minimum wage, though, is not about this year, but thinking in a bit longer term, because as we noted, we haven't raised the minimum wage for 12 years. That's the longest the federal minimum wage has not been increased since we have had a minimum wage in 1938, since 1938. So, I think we should think about where do we want to be 3, 4, 5 years from now, when hopefully the pandemic will be ancient history. So I think it's important to phase the minimum wage in and not have a big increase up front. It's also possible, and I hope Congress will do this, is to provide relief to small businesses, especially those who have to pay a higher minimum wage in this environment during the phase-in period, to provide relief. We did that last time around when we increased the federal minimum wage. I think we can do more this time around, but that's an important consideration. And I think that the federal government can and should help with that.
The small businesses that you mentioned, anecdotally, I've heard from a few of them that have said that if the minimum wage is increased to $15 an hour, it's going to put a hold on my business hiring new people, just as you described what we meant by job losses. But I wonder, yeah, is it like a self-fulfilling kind of prophecy that small businesses say, I can't afford that, and I'm just not going to hire people? Does it become that self-fulfilling prophecy?
I don't think it actually ends up being that, and for the following reason. I think sometimes it's small business owners don't fully appreciate that when they're increasing the wage because of a minimum wage mandate, so are all their competitors. And so the most common and very well documented evidence is that prices rise. So your burger may cost 50 cent more now, okay? And the price increases and the price adjustment ends up paying for the bulk of the cost increase for every minimum wage increase that we have seen in history. And so what that means is you have middle and higher income consumers in net paying a bit more for lower wage workers to get a raise. And that's and that price adjustment, which I think some business owners, if you think about, well, what happens if I raise my price and no one else does? Yeah, I'm going to lose a lot of customers. But that's not really what happens with the minimum wage when all of us face the same wage increase and the cost pressure. It just gets built into the pricing. And so we see this over and over again. There's lots of really, solid evidence on this issue. And so that adjustment turns out to be an important part of the story.
Let's take another phone call from Theron in Lancaster. Theron, you're on Smart Talk.
Hi, Scott. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
I guess I wanted to pose a question. I have been pondering on this a little bit recently, and I can agree a little bit with both sides. Obviously, the raising the minimum wage would help the lowest common denominator of our country, but I also think that it will put a large strain, as we've been saying, on small business owners. I'd like your guests to conjecture a little bit on the idea of a mandatory minimum raise instead of a minimum wage, so that possibly you could incentivize workers and citizens to stay stationary in their place of work, but it also gives business owners a smooth transition, and also it only requires them to input more into the citizens and workers and laborers who actually put into their profit.
Theron, thank you very much for your call. Dr. Dubé, that's kind of a different way to think about this. What about that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think in the short run, that could work well when everyone's at the same jobs, right? You can say, well, everyone gets to 10%, 15% raise or something along those lines. But in a few years, most people in minimum wage jobs may not be exactly the same job. And so you have a new position. So it becomes tricky to say, well, what position is that? What wage should that be set at? right? So, because then it's not just adjusting a previous wage, but it's actually creating a new paid wage to begin with. And then the federal government or the policy wouldn't speak to how to set that wage. And so it becomes tricky, I think, in beyond the short run to think just of a raise. But it is true that I think phasing it in over time, so you don't have this one big jump, so the minimum is rising at a sort of a steady level, is important. And, you know, the other, I think I didn't answer your previous listener's second question, which was about what about indexing? I think that's an extremely important point, which actually also builds in a smoother transition over time. So in the Congress right now, the proposed bill, the Raise the Wage Act, actually would tie future increases, right, after having raised it to 15 by 2024, to the median wage in the U.S., so the growth in the median wage. So every year it grows a little bit. And then we don't go through 12 years without raising the minimum and then thinking about doubling it. And so that, I think, is that indexation is actually an extremely important thing. About 8 states do that with indexing it to cost of living. That prevents having these big jumps and then delays and stagnation.
Let's take another phone call from Amanda in Montoursville. Amanda, what's your question or comment here on Smart Talk?
Good morning, Scott. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
My question is about the regionalization that a couple callers ago had mentioned. I was curious if your guests have done any research on how that would affect what we call the brain drain. So I'm in rural Pennsylvania, and one of the big things that we have an issue with is our young people leaving for higher wages. Is there any research on that, or what does your guest think about that?
Good question, Amanda. Thank you very much for your call. Dr. Dubé?
Yeah, so I think in general, if you do allow for regional differences, that can affect migration, right? So in general, wages are important source important determinant of migration, both between areas and between urban and rural areas across states. Specifically around minimum wage, there hasn't been a lot of documentation that that migration responds strongly, but there's some evidence, especially for sort of immigrant location choice. Seems to partly depend on what the local minimum wage is. So yes, I think that is one consideration. And so that actually would mean if you allowed for regional differences, that could put that you could end up seeing more migration out of lower wage rural areas. So that's actually one of the reasons some people don't want to have regional differences, because then you're sort of baking in some of the gap between certain areas, for eternity. And so that's sort of one of the reasons why some people seem to prefer a flat wage. But look, I think there are real pros and cons to how exactly to set it. And I think there are good arguments for regionalization. There are also some concerns about regionalization.
Dr. Dubé, you talked about regional differences. What about certain industries? Would there be certain industries that would be impacted more positively, more negatively with a minimum wage? I mean, I hear most often from like the service industry, restaurants, that kind of thing, that they say we can't afford to do this.
Yeah, that's an excellent question. So I think where the evidence suggests more negative impact on jobs is in manufacturing and tradable goods sectors. So when the minimum wage rises, we do see evidence of reduced hiring in manufacturing sector. Now, here's the thing. Today in the United States, manufacturing jobs are a very small sliver of minimum wage workforce, or who would be affected by $15, for example. That's why that ends up not being a really important part of the overall story. In contrast, the majority of workers who are affected by a minimum wage increase are in either restaurant or retail. Those are the two big places, as well as in some cases also in health and other services, but mostly in the service sector. And that ends up mattering because, you know, when it comes to manufacturing, the prices are set not at the very local level. It usually set more at regional, national, or sometimes even international level. So you can't just pass through cost increases as price increases as easily. And that's one of the reasons why you do see some more evidence of job loss in that sector. But in contrast, today, most of minimum wage workers are in service sectors where basically the price setting is a lot more local, and that actually allows easier price pass through and adjustment. And that's why it reduces the threat of job loss substantially.
Another question from a listener wanted to know, wouldn't increasing the minimum wage raise wages for other workers as well, those that are close to or maybe making below $15 an hour now?
Great question. Yeah. So we sometimes call that wage spillovers or ripple effects. And absolutely, that we have, you know, good handle on that question. And what we see is that when the minimum wage is raised, you know, let's say, you know, to $10 an hour, you may see wages rise for another jobs that were paying maybe $11, $12, maybe even $13. So $2 to $3 above the minimum, those jobs actually do see some increase. And then beyond that, there's no impact at all on wages. So yes, we do see some additional spillover. So those are workers who are indirectly affected by the policy. That ends up being, you know, a good number of workers, but it's not that everyone throughout the distribution of wages gets a bump from a minimum increase.
Dr. Dubé, we're almost out of time, but, you know, when we're looking at numbers, and, you know, I started off this segment by talking about how both sides of this debate can make some good points. I mean, what your research has shown is that millions of people would get raises. You know, a lot of them would be lifted out of poverty, but there would be some job losses. And by job losses, we mean there would be people who wouldn't, businesses that, or employers that wouldn't be as quick to hire. I guess the question I have is, let's drill down to the numbers a little bit. I mean, we're talking in generalities a lot and using words like modest and things like that. If you're one of the people or you're one of the businesses that are impacted by this, that's your life rather than, you know, part of the statistics. You know what I mean? Where I'm getting here is that, you know, this could have a greater impact on some people and some employers more so than others.
That's absolutely true. You know, it just on both sides, you know, of course, if you don't get a raise, and if you're trying to struggle on 725, that's, you know, that's a real thing. If you end up being a business that ends up shutting down, that's also a real thing. It is important to keep in mind that, you know, small businesses, especially in hospitality, which has a lot of minimum wage workers, businesses go in and out of business all the time, like every year. It doesn't matter what happens to the minimum wage. There's a lot of different things. So just there's a lot of churn. That doesn't make it any easier for people, for business owners who end up having to shut down. But it does mean that this churn is the background in which any impact of the minimum wage would have, which would be much smaller, even in the most pessimistic scenario, than just all the other things that lead, you know, to business to either start or shut down. But it is important to keep in mind, absolutely, the real human aspect of it. And that is really on both sides of the equation here.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a call from Jim in Lancaster. Jim, you're on the air.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. How are you?
You're welcome. Good, doing well. What's your question, Jim?
Good. So I have a couple of questions for you. First, for both of you, have either of you ever owned and operated a small business before?
No, I don't see why that's relevant, but go ahead.
You don't know why that's relevant. So you're prescribing solutions for small businesses, but neither of you have ever even run a small business before. I ran a small business for 28 years, and I happen to be a small business consultant, and I know that labor costs are 30 to 35% of the cost of running a business. So if government gets involved and artificially drives up the cost of labor, all it's going to do is hurt the businesses. They're going to have to pass that cost on to their clients. It's going to raise prices, or it's going to drive them out of business, number one. My second question for you, and thank you for being honest, my second question for you is, where do you find in the United States Constitution that the federal government has the authority to set wage levels for private business? Where do you find that in the Constitution?
I don't think it is in the Constitution. Hey, Jim, thank you very much for your call. The reason I said I don't think that's relevant, I mean, I'm asking the questions, and Dr. Dubé has researched this thoroughly. And if we only can hear from people who have run businesses, then we only have kind of a one-sided conversation that leaves a lot of people out of it. So, Dr. Dubé, as far as the constitutional question, this is not a constitutional issue, is it?
Well, I mean, let me just say one other thing about caller's question. You know, I think that's it's a fair issue, that do we understand the experiences of small businesses. I do not run a small business, but I have studied how millions of small businesses have responded to hundreds of minimum wage increases. One of the ways they actually do is something that the caller mentioned, that pass on the increases through prices. It's true in restaurants, labor costs are about a third of, on average, a third of overall costs. And what that means is that when the wage rises, given the number of people who usually are at minimum wage workers, a burger may actually cost 50 cent more. And if you actually raise the price of burgers in the entire market by 50 cents more or so, that ends up covering most of the cost of the wage increase. And that's a very important margin, like I said before, of adjustment, how small or large businesses adjust to the cost pressures. In terms of constitutionality, you know, for a while, so the Supreme Court actually ruled that, in fact, the federal government did not have the right to set the minimum wage. It wasn't until 1938 that actually the United States federal government had any minimum wage. And that's because earlier Supreme Courts had ruled it unconstitutional. Since 1938, though, there hasn't really been any question about the issue of constitutionality. Originally, it was passed in terms of the ability of the federal government to regulate interstate commerce. So I think that, yes, I'm not a legal scholar, I'm an economist, but I don't think legal scholars today question the ability or the right of the federal government to set a minimum wage. That's different from saying what the federal government should do, and I think that's a debate worth having, but whether it can do it or not is not really a debate we have in this country at this point.
You know, I introduced you, Dr. Dubé, saying that I wanted to have someone on the program who is a nonpartisan researcher without a political agenda. Would you say that's the case for you?
It is. I don't, you know, I actually am mostly interested in understanding how effective policies are. And, you know, because what we want to do is we want to we want to use policies that make sense, because if it doesn't make sense, then why do them? And so my entire reason for having gone into this question is because I wanted to actually see, is it actually worth raising the federal minimum wage, or are the costs too high? Because it's possible, right? Based on economic theory, it's possible that the costs would be too high. So we should really only do it if the benefits exceed the costs. And that's what I did. And that's why, you know, I worked with the Conservative Party in the UK to look at the question and see, you know, if it makes sense. And at some point, we may actually find that the minimum wage is too high. Is it possible that $15 by 2025 may be too high in some parts of the country? It's possible. I think looking at the evidence so far, I'm optimistic about it, but I think there are reasonable concerns. And that's why this conversation is very useful.
Dr. Aaron Dubay is professor at the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences in the Department of Economics at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. His Washington Post column talking about the minimum wage was published just last week. We'll have a link to that on our website, WITF.org/smarttalk. Dr. Dubay, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The U Visa program, designed to provide a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants who are the victims of crime but assist law enforcement, is significantly backed up. As a result, immigrants who may be eligible to become legal U.S. residents could be deported while waiting for their cases to be heard. A group of attorneys is pushing to speed up the U visa program. Two of them are with us today. Whitney Phelps is the managing attorney with community programs with the Pennsylvania Immigration Resource Center. And David Friedman is an attorney with Barley Snyder Attorneys at Law. Welcome both of you to the program. Whitney Phelps, let me start with you. What is the U visa program and how does it work, or how is it supposed to work?
Well, you gave a pretty great summary as far as what it actually is. It's for immigrants who are victims of serious crimes here in the U.S. who suffer mental or physical harm as a result of that crime and are helpful with law enforcement, either in the investigation or prosecution of the offense. So in a perfect world, what would happen is the victim would get connected with an immigration service, legal service provider who would help prepare the application. Part of that is getting a certification from law enforcement or from the prosecution, basically saying, yes, this person was the victim of a crime. Yes, they helped with the investigation or the prosecution. That certification is valid for 6 months. So in theory, you want your entire application for U non-immigrant status or U visa filed within that 6 months. And then it's just a waiting game after that. You get your fingerprints done so that they can do an FBI background check. And then you wait some more.
Well, I think that
about
waiting,
5 years later or 4 to 5 years later, you actually end up with work authorization.
So that's what's happening now. David Friedman, is that what is happening now? I mean, ideally, how long should an immigrant who has become part of the U visa program, how long should they wait? And why are they waiting for so long now?
Why they're waiting for so long now, I'm not sure about. But if we look at the historical processing times that are available through the Immigration Service, we see that back in 2015, it was about 9 months. 2016, it was about a year and a half. Currently, it's taken up to 5 years for United States Citizenship and Immigration Services to process these applications. We're not entirely sure why that is. And that's one of the goals of this litigation project that Whitney and I are working on, is to kind of pull back the curtain and see why it is taking the government so long to process these applications.
So that litigation you're talking about, you're suing the government on what grounds? What are you trying to find out? You mentioned some of it, but what are you trying to find out here?
We're trying to find out why the program has basically ground to a halt. The Department of Homeland Security has a regulation on its books that says, and I'm going to quote it right here for you, Scott. It says, all eligible petitioners who are not granted a U-1 non-immigrant status must be placed on a waiting list. And that waiting list is very important, because when you get on that waiting list as a U visa applicant, you get employment authorization and you get a promise from the government that they won't deport you while they're waiting for your U visa to process. But for some reason, people are not making it onto that list, or very few people are making it onto that list. We suspect that maybe the government is taking resources and putting them other places, but we're not entirely sure. So what we have is, we have 21 folks who are clients of Whitney's organization, the Pennsylvania Immigration Resource Center, who have filed U visa applications that have been pending for at least 3.5-4 years. We're filing lawsuits lawsuits against them in federal district court under the Administrative Procedure Act, alleging that these have been unreasonable delays and asking the courts not to grant these folks their U visa immigrant status, but to simply make the government decide whether they are eligible.
Whitney Phelps, have there actually been people who have been deported because they haven't been put on that list?
So that's kind of a complicated question. I mean, personally, within our agency and in my legal experience, I've not had anybody in that situation, but most of the time that's because I'm able, or we're able, to work out some sort of deal of sorts with the immigration court. But it certainly can happen, and I'm sure it has happened. excuse me, the reason behind that is you can actually receive U visas from outside the United States. So what the trial attorney for the government in immigration court is saying, they generally argue that, well, if you're eligible for a U visa, you can get it from outside the United States. So why don't you just go back to your home country and wait your turn to come back in once your U visa is approved? Not obviously taking into consideration the significant trauma this person suffered, having been the victim of a crime in the U.S., obviously being separated from family for some unknown period of time. It sounds like a simple request, but really what they're asking is more than somebody should be asked to have to do in order to get this status.
So, Mr. Freeman, give us an example. I mean, we've kind of described this around the edges of an undocumented immigrant who has been the victim of crime but assists police. Give me an example. Describe some of these cases that have actually occurred.
Well, the overwhelming majority of folks who are U visa applicants are victims of sexual assault or domestic violence. I've personally represented folks who have also testified at murder trials that have resulted in folks being convicted of murder and sentenced to life in prison. I've also represented a young woman now who was a victim of repeated sexual assaults when she was very, very young. So these are very, very serious crimes. And these are folks who have gone through quite a bit to help the government. They've kept up their end of the bargain. And so it's our view that it's time for the government to keep up its end of the bargain.
You know, Whitney, one thing that I understand is that there are immigrants who, undocumented immigrants, who are maybe hesitant to even apply for a U visa. Is that the case?
Yeah, absolutely. You're providing your information to the government and trusting that the government's going to, again, follow through on its commitments. In the past, we did not see denied U visas sent to immigration court or issued notices to appear, which initiates the immigration removal process. But now, in the last 3-ish years, that policy has changed. And if you file for a U visa, but your U visa is denied for one reason or another, they send your case to immigration court. So that basically begins the deportation process. So yeah, it's a very tough decision for somebody to have to make. And it's hard to decide if it's worth waiting 5 years to even get a decision. Yeah, so there's a lot of things that somebody has to weigh in deciding whether or not they want to move forward.
I think, you know, when you just said the last 3 years, that was obviously during the Trump administration when President Trump made immigration one of the keystones of his policies. You know, we don't have time to get into the political aspects of this, but David Freedman, we only have about a minute left, actually less than a minute. What would be an ideal outcome to your litigation?
Well, Mr. Lamar, I mean, I think you raise a good point here. The Department of Homeland Security is currently facing a number of very intractable problems, but this one is not that intractable. This is an easy problem for the Department of Homeland Security to resolve. It doesn't require an act of Congress. It doesn't even require new regulations. We have the regulations on the book, which I quoted to you before. All the Department of Homeland Security has to do is issue an internal memo directing its agents to process these U visa applications to put the folks on the waiting list, which will provide them with protection from deportation and employment authorization. And if the Department of Homeland Security does that, this problem will at least partially be solved. There's other problems, but this is the first problem that can be solved.
David Friedman is an attorney at Barley Snyder Attorneys at Law. Whitney Phelps, managing attorney with community programs with the Pennsylvania Immigration Resource Center. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.